Welcome to Boston Globe Live. This program is intended for a print and paid audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Good afternoon, everyone. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Friday, June 12th edition of the Boston Globe. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Beverly, reading with Alita, live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester. We begin with the front page news. With fans here at last, the party is definitely on. World Cup intensity hits home as massive crowds do their thing. By Chris Saris and Omar Mohammed and Ty Theodora, Globe staff and Globe correspondents. World Cup fever finally arrived in Boston on Thursday in an early morning burst of bagpipe music, colorful soccer jerseys, and kilts. Lots and lots of kilts. By mid-morning, the area around Faneuil Hall Marketplace was packed with Scottish soccer fans wearing the blue tartan of their cultural garb, many already 16 ounces deep into their celebrations. And one Boston resident took to social media to complain of being woken at the crack of dawn by a kilt-clad bagpipe player. Meanwhile, at a park in East Boston, workers inflated a 2,000-pound soccer ball at the site of another FanFest watch party. Later in the afternoon, fans of the Mexico national team gathered in the park to cheer on their team in a 2-0 win over South Africa in the first game of the tournament. All across Greater Boston, boisterous tourists from Scotland, Haiti, France, and Morocco packed into nearly every open bar and restaurant. Despite the sweltering heat, many wore soccer scarves and capes bearing their national colors. And with that, in just one day's time, a city that seemed to shrug at hosting the world's biggest sport event ever saw joyous intensity in the beautiful game brings out in its fans. And by all accounts, Bostonians, while known for their gruffness and stoicism, have welcomed the massive crowd of visitors with warmth and tolerance. That warm welcome, Matt, may well be put to the test because there is a lot of soccer in the weeks ahead. This is the biggest World Cup in history, featuring more teams than ever before, 48 countries playing in venues across the United States, Mexico, and Canada, and with the final in New Jersey on July 19. There will be a grand total of 104 games over 39 days. Seven of those matches will be held at Gillette, which has been named Boston Stadium for the tournament. And by Julian Surapuro, Globe staff, we have Ultimate Trump, cage fights at the White House. When he's encountered particularly difficult times during his political career, President Trump has turned to a reliable refuge, ultimate fighting. Just months after the January 6th at the riot, when Trump's political future was at its most uncertain, he popped up at an ultimate fighting championship fight in Las Vegas. 2 years later, days removed from pleading not guilty to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in New York, Trump was again cage-side at a UFC event in Miami, greeted by raucous chants of USA, and again in the year after, shortly after he was found guilty on all 34 counts, Trump was cheered by a UFC crowd in New Jersey. For a president with an eye for spectacle, who fancies himself a fighter above all else, the marriage is natural. Much of the UFC's overwhelming young male audience also counts themselves as part of his mega base. When general public opinion of Trump is low, he knows the UFC crowd, its fighters, and the company's top brass all have his back. In short, it's Trump's safe place. And now, at a time when his approval ratings are near a record low, he's brought it to the White House backyard. And similar to those bouts of old, the only people who will be able to get as close to the fighting cage as I did to write this will be elites. This is an invite-only event. No tickets will be sold to the public. Attendees must either be summoned by the president himself, purchase a $1.5 million VIP sponsorship package, be a member of the military, or get the nod from the UFC president, Dana White. All this comes at a hefty cost. White has said the UFC is set to lose $30 million on the event, but will not receive any taxpayer money. A lawsuit attempting to stop the event revealed recently it has cost at least $60 million. Even so, for a marketing opportunity such as this, it's a small price to pay. The fights will surely be the pinnacle of mutually beneficial relationship between Trump and White in the UFC that began in 2001. Back then, UFC was far from mainstream. The late Republican Senator John McCain famously derided mixed martial arts as human cockfighting in 1996 and led efforts to ban the sport across the country. As such, White struggled to find a venue that would host the UFC for his first fight in charge of the promotion. In stepped Trump, who offered up the casino he owned in Atlantic City that was known as the Taj Mahal. And the rest is history. And moving on to the nation section of the Globe, meteorologists talk of a Godzilla El Nino cycle. Experts fear cost of droughts, fires, U.S. effects vary. By Seth Bornstein, Associated Press. El Nino, nature's chaotic climate agent, has formed in a warmed-up Pacific Ocean and is expected to grow to historic strength, meteorologists announced Thursday. Experts said that the El Nino, a natural warming cycle, should further heat a globe already warming from fossil fuel pollution and will likely turbocharge extreme weather across the planet. Meteorologists forecast it will rival or exceed a record El Nino that began in 1997 and helped trigger billions of dollars in damage from heat waves, floods, droughts, tornadoes, and wildfires. The U.S. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration officially confirmed the existence of the El Nino. NOAA's announcement said there's a 63% that the El Nino will get so intense this late fall and early winter that it would rank among the largest El Nino events in the historical record going back to 1950. The weather pattern's effects vary by region. El Nino often dampens but doesn't eliminate Atlantic hurricane season activity, but increases it in the Pacific. So while the U.S. and Gulf Coast may get a break, Hawaii and other islands are in more danger. The weather extremes caused by an El Nino also depend on when it develops. Usually, El Ninos form in the summer, peak in the late fall or early winter, and peter out in the next spring. However, Ihan's team forecasts that this El Nino will peak a month or two earlier based on strong early signs from recent weeks. Scientists predict El Ninos as the world warms from the burning of coal, oil, and gas. It is too early to say if this El Nino is part of that. Even before it officially formed, this El Nino has gotten nicknames ranging from Super to Godzilla. Instead of scared, we can ask people to be prepared. People watch for Trump's name to leave the Kennedy Center. Washington Post. Every day for the past week and a half, Andrew Martin has pulled up his bicycling shorts, hopped on his 8-year-old bike, and biked to the banks of the Potomac River to photograph himself in front of the Kennedy Center. He is proving that the name Donald J. Trump is still there, and waiting for it to come down, perhaps on Friday, today. Martin's daily missives have turned him into a hero for a certain subset of social media followers. people who are as eager as he is to see Trump's name ripped from the building, and who want their feeds populated with reports from other humans, not machines. Martin, 51, is a Washingtonian, a government librarian, and a lifelong fan of the Kennedy Center. As a young child, he visited the center with his parents. As an adult, he cheered while his wife, Julie, sang in the concert hall with the Choral Arts Society of Washington. As a parent, he beamed watching his youngest daughter serve as a mini maestro for a Christmas Eve performance of Hark the Herald Angels Sing. He was devastated when Trump's name was added to the building, and elated when a federal judge ordered its removal. But it was an AI video that brought Martin back to the arts institution. The weekend after the ruling, which also halted plans to close the building for 2 years of renovation, a striking video of the center circulated online. It showed crowds cheering as workers in heavy parkas tore the Trump name from the building, letters crashing dramatically to the ground. Though the video was posted alongside the real images of cherry pickers outside the Kennedy Center, Martin immediately suspected it was fake. So during his lunch break, he took a 20-minute bike ride and snapped a picture to prove Trump's name was yet to come down. "It turns out there's a real hunger for the truth," he says. "There's a lot of people out there who really want to know what's actually going on, but there's an equal amount of people feeding the AI slop machine." After his first post went viral, followers began asking him to bring along a physical newspaper each day to prove the date and to prove he was really biking there every day. "It makes it feel like a hostage video," he laughs, "like a proof-of-life video." Since Trump's takeover, the center has become a frequent site of protests, responding to the president's statements and the institution's changes. With his daily 10-mile ride, Martin has joined a small community of people keeping vigil at the center. The most constant presence and his newest friend is Laura Bly, a Virginia woman who spent 10 years working backstage with the National Symphony Orchestra. Now, as the symphony nears its centennial anniversary, Bly worries about its future. "The Kennedy Center will not approve their budget, so they can't formalize and announce their next season." Interest in Martin's posts ramped up the clock. Interest in Martin's post ramped up as the clock has wound down on the judge's order to remove Trump's name from the building. The deadline is Friday, today. "We are complying with the court's order while evaluating all legal options to preserve this revitalization and recognize President Trump's leadership," the center's spokesperson said. And in last pivot, Trump retracts threat to attack. President Trump began Thursday by threatening to bomb Iran for a third consecutive night and then seize Karg Island, Iran's main oil exports hub in the Persian Gulf, an escalation that risked opening a deadly new chapter in the months-long war. Hours later, he abruptly reversed course. In a post on social media, he said he had called off the strikes planned on Thursday night based on the fact that discussion with the Islamic Republic of Iran had been brought to the highest level of Iranian leadership and approved. At an event in the Oval Office on Thursday afternoon, Trump said the U.S. and Iran had agreed to a deal subject to finalization of documents and that it could be signed in Europe as soon as this weekend at a ceremony with President J.D. Vance. But a spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry pushed back on Trump's assertion that both sides had reached an agreement. Trump's pivot was the latest in a dizzying pattern by the president, alternating between threats to escalate the war and claims that Iran is close to signing a deal. And we will be right back after this short break. The
The following is a public service announcement from the Worcester, Massachusetts Association for the Blind Support Group. Though vision and blind persons in the Worcester area are fortunate to have a support group sponsored by the Massachusetts Association for the Blind in Worcester, the group meets monthly at the Worcester Senior Center. The group provides information and resources to assist with daily living, assistive technology, transportation, and friendship. For more information, please call Marion at 508-754-0672. Again, that's Marion at 508-754-0672.
And we are back, and we'll continue with Alida.
In today's opinion page, an editorial. Plattner won over Maine Democrats. Can he win in November? Maine Democrats have spoken, and their decision should come as no surprise. Despite the steady drip of damaging revelations about Graham Plattner's past, the combat veteran turned oyster farmer easily won Tuesday's Democratic primary for U.S. Senate, gaining more than 70% of the vote. He will now face five-term Republican Senator Susan Collins in the November general election. On Morning Joe, the morning after the primary day, the co-hosts asked Plattner whether there would be more revelations to come. In his response, he didn't exactly say no. "I just want to make this clear," Plattner told Brzezinski. "There's nothing out there that is actually concerning. People will make everything seem very concerning because that's what people do in politics. This is what everyone wants to make the campaign about, so that we do not talk about the struggles of working Mainers." If that sounds like a dodge, it almost certainly was. So you can assume that more embarrassing reports, perhaps with pictures, will trickle out in the weeks to come. But Plattner's response also contained a grain of truth, namely that the national debate over the who the real Graham Plattner might be will rage on, all but drowning out the substantive debate over whether Collins deserves a sixth term. It is more than reasonable to question whether Plattner has the character and values one should expect in a U.S. senator. But at the end of the day, it is a question that must be answered by Maine voters, not the national media, Washington pundits, or Democrats in other states. And therein lies the challenge for Plattner. Can he convince a majority of Mainers that he has indeed come to grips with the war-induced PTSD he says underlies his rage, rashness, and often toxic behavior? If he can, there is strong evidence that many residents of his state are open to his populist and progressive message. He has endorsed universal health care, spoken passionately about the plight of working people, vowed to get the U.S. out of Middle East wars, and called for raising taxes on the wealthy and breaking up tech monopolies. While Republicans say his message is far too left-wing for middle-of-the-road Maine, polls have shown him ahead of Collins, though the margin has tightened in recent weeks. His message, amplified by his abundant vigor and charm on the stump, also drove Governor Janet Mills, the Democratic establishment's favored candidate, to suspend her campaign in April after trailing Plattner by a wide margin. But if it seems that many Maine voters are prepared to give Plattner the benefit of the doubt, warts and all, he still needs to seal the deal by doing the hard work of answering voters' questions honestly. Collins, among the last of New England's once proud tradition of moderate Republicans, cannot be counted out. She is a supporter of abortion rights, has worked to provide solid constituent services, and has staked out more reasonable approaches to immigration than the xenophobic dogma that governs the Republican Party under Trump. But outsider politicians can be a powerful draw these days, and Collins has spent a lifetime in government. More to the point, she has proven unable, or unwilling, to moderate her party's radical shift to the right under Trump. Neither has she done much to counter Trump's blatant corruption or slow his chaotic decimation of important federal agencies. Many Mainers seem ready to restore Congress as a co-equal branch to the presidency. The door for Plattner may no longer be wide open, but it is not yet closed. It is up to him to walk through it, with integrity, maturity, and honestly, like a good senator would. Should Congress set standards for AI? Two columns, why Congress must lead on AI standards, and Congress shouldn't freeze state AI safeguards. Why Congress must lead on AI standards, by Lori Trahan, U.S. Representative representing Massachusetts' 3rd Congressional District and a member of the Democratic House leadership. America needs a strong national strategy on artificial intelligence, and we need it now. AI is moving at breakneck speed, producing newer and more powerful models that pose real risks to safety, national security, and the nation's workforce. Each day that passes without a comprehensive federal standard puts us further behind and puts every American at greater risk. The promise is enormous, nowhere clearer than in Massachusetts. However, the same technology that could cure disease can also cause profound harm. Parents are seeing chatbots cause real harm to their children. Workers are worried about their job prospects, and educators are struggling to find healthy ways to implement this new technology in class. In the absence of federal regulatory framework, power concentrates in the hands of a small number of companies racing to build the most potent technology in human history. They ask us to trust them while they write the rules of the road themselves. We've seen this movie before. Lawmakers spent the last two decades playing catch-up on social media giants, and the public is still paying the price. That is why I and Republican Jay Obernolte of California have crafted federal legislation that governs the development of AI models. Together, we crafted the Great American Intelligence Act, a discussion draft that creates two distinct lanes. It tasks the federal government with setting uniform safety rules for how the most powerful models are developed and tested, a federal standard that, for 3 years, would take the place of a handful of state laws governing the development stage, so that innovators face one rule book, not 50. We're at a pivotal moment. AI models will only grow more capable, and the glaring risks will only grow with them. The Great American Artificial Intelligence Act is meant to help unlock a comprehensive, bipartisan federal AI strategy, one that lets Massachusetts lead. Congress shouldn't freeze state AI safeguards. By Brad Carson, former U.S. Representative from Oklahoma and President of Americans for Responsible Innovation. Representative Lori Trahan of Massachusetts is right that Congress should pass national safeguards for artificial intelligence. But that work cannot begin by taking away the one source of AI accountability that has actually moved while Congress has stalled, the states, including Massachusetts. A draft bill filed this month by Trahan, a Democrat, and Republican Representative Jay Obernolte of California threatens to freeze state regulation of companies developing AI for 3 years. Specifically, it would block states from enforcing laws that regulate AI models in their development and pre-release safety decisions on the grounds that those regulations impact interstate commerce. That's the stage where training data is chosen, models are tested, risks are measured, and release decisions are made. In exchange for that ban on state regulation, the bill proposes a set of transparency measures and government programs without the teeth to hold AI companies accountable for unsafe practices. While the draft bill funds federal research into what might constitute safe AI, nothing in it prevents an AI company from releasing a model that fails to meet child, worker, or consumer safety standards. That is probably the reason why the tech industry and its lobbyists have applauded the legislation, while a broad coalition of labor unions, child safety advocates, civil liberty groups, and grassroots organizations have raised the alarm. Instead of offering a draft bill that sets a federal ceiling on AI regulation and prevents state lawmakers from addressing emerging AI harms, Congress should set a floor, requiring tech companies to meet real standards that protect American communities without freezing state authorities. Americans have seen what happens when the federal government refuses to hold big tech accountable. Let's do AI regulation without repeating the mistakes of the social media era and tying the hands of states looking to do the right thing. In business news, Power Play, a column by Shirley Leung. Running again for DA, Rollins is defiant. Says she feels shame, but asserts she was truthful, by Shirley Leung. As Rachel Rollins launches her improbable political comeback, her best defense may be a good offense. At least that seems to be her modus operandi as she sat down for her first lengthy media interview since resigning as U.S. attorney 3 years ago amid two federal probes detailing egregious and flagrant ethics breaches. I will own that this entire situation when I was U.S. attorney was incredibly messy, Rollins told me in a joint interview with WGBH's Jim Brody. I feel profound embarrassment. I feel shame, like remorse about what happened. Yet Rollins cannot bring herself to say she did anything wrong, at least without knowing more about how the Department of Justice Inspector General and the Office of Special Counsel drew their conclusions that she violated the Hatch Act, which bars federal workers from partisan political activities by attending a 2022 fundraiser with Jill Biden and separately using her office to influence a Suffolk district attorney's race. I concede that they don't think I was truthful, Rollins said. I believe I was. The 55-year-old Roxbury resident is emerging out of exile because she's running for Suffolk district attorney again, a role that catapulted her onto the political stage in 2018. She was among the first in the nation to run as a progressive prosecutor, pledging not to pursue low-level crimes like shoplifting. Today, Rollins likens herself to other professionals who were accused of various crimes and profess their innocence and ultimately, with the help of her office, were vindicated. She knows she's asking a lot of voters to look past her transgressions, both of which involve improper use of political power. Still, Rollins remains characteristically defiant. She argues that scandals may not derail candidates the way they used to, drawing a parallel with Graham Plattner, who easily won the Democratic nomination on Tuesday, despite having a Nazi tattoo and allegations he mistreated women. And we'll take a brief break and be back with more news.
Hi, my name's Owen Devlin, and this is my story. When my doctor told me I was losing my vision, I was devastated. I worried about my future. How would I attend college, find a great job, start a family, or even travel around my own neighborhood? Luckily, my doctor also told me about the Mass Commission for the Blind. They connected me and my family to a counselor who helped us to set a vision for my future, one that included assistive technology to allow me to go to school and find a meaningful job, a white cane to help me navigate, and even tips on how to use Google Maps on my mobile phone. I found out that losing my vision wasn't the end of the world.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
You are listening to Boston Globe Live, a production of Audio Journal. And I am back with news from the Nation section of the Globe. House rejects extension of foreign spying tool. Contentious law, choice of chief, splinter parties. New York Times. Members of Congress departed Washington on Thursday without acting to extend one of the government's most powerful surveillance tools for collecting information on foreign threats overseas, all but assuring that the law will expire as scheduled Saturday. In a 218-98 vote, the House rejected a measure to temporarily renew a statute that underpins the government's cornerstone electronic spying program, known as Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Not long afterwards, Democrats blocked a similar last-ditch effort in the Senate, underscoring the stalemate before a Friday midnight deadline to extend. Bipartisan lawmakers had until recently been negotiating some marginal changes to the law in a push to earn enough support from privacy advocates to renew the authority for 3 years. But the group splintered after President Trump said last week he was installing Bill Pulte, a top housing official and a close ally who has no intelligence background, as acting director of the National Intelligence. Democrats, including those who had been pushing for the spy law's renewal, said they would not pass legislation extending it unless Trump backed down from his pick of Pulte or nominated a suitable permanent pick. Up until Thursday afternoon, the president had refused, despite Republican entrees to do so or risk a lapse of a critical surveillance power. But hours after the extension bill failed in the House and lawmakers began leaving Washington for a week-long recess, Trump said he would nominate Jay Clayton as his permanent pick for chief spy. It was not immediately clear whether Democrats would view Clayton more favorably than Pulte, and the announcement appeared to be too late to prevent the expiration of Section 702. The expiring authority permits the government to collect from U.S. technology companies like Google and AT&T the communications of foreigners located abroad without a warrant when seeking foreign intelligence information. Officials from multiple administrations have credited the program with helping identify terrorist plots, combat cyber attacks, and monitor the activity of foreign adversaries. Should the Section 702 statute sunset, a built-in safety mechanism would most likely enable it to continue operating. The surveillance court that oversees FISA issued new annual certifications for the program in March, meaning the National Security Agency could continue to operate at least until next spring, though such a scenario could invite legal challenges from the companies that the law requires to share communications data. And continuing from the Nation section, FDA offers brief explanation for its okay of fruity vapes. Fruit-flavored e-cigarettes recently authorized by the Food and Drug Administration were not significantly better at helping smokers quit than tobacco-flavored e-cigarettes. The FDA last month gave its okay to fruit-flavored vapes, essentially endorsing them as a less harmful alternative to traditional cigarettes. The decision came despite the agency's long-standing position that such flavors appeal to children and must show extra health benefits to warrant approval for adults. Health groups and Washington lawmakers quickly condemned the decision and have called for an explanation. A 6-page FDA memo released this week provides more details about the agency's rationale. In it, FDA regulators appear to sidestep previous statements about the risks of sweet vaping flavors while acknowledging shortcomings in the data submitted by vape manufacturer Glass Inc. To meet federal standards, the companies must show that their products benefit public health. In practice, that means demonstrating that their vapes help adult smokers switch or quit cigarettes while not attracting underage use by teens. Smokers who tried Glass vapes were much more likely to completely switch from cigarettes over the course of a 3-month study, according to the memo. But the data did not show statistically significant differences between adults using the company's mango and blueberry flavors and those using a tobacco-flavored e-cigarette. The agency's authorization also runs counter to recent FDA guidelines advising companies that fruit and dessert flavors would have to meet a high evidentiary standard for adult use, given their risks to children. The FDA document is also unusual in its brevity. The short memo on Glass does not include details such as how many smokers the firm studied. And moving on to the world section of the globe, Brazil reports drop in Amazon deforestation states, pushing back on U.S. tariffs, Associated Press. Brazilian officials on Thursday announced a sharp drop in deforestation rates, pushing back on one of the arguments that the Trump administration used last week to justify additional tariffs on the South American country. In May, Amazon deforestation was 61.4% lower than in the same month in 2025, according to officials from the National Institute for Space Research and the Ministry of Environment. Still, nearly 143 square miles of the rainforest were cleared. Deforestation over the same period fell 12% in the Cerrado, a savanna in central Brazil that has long been under pressure from the powerful agribusiness sector. Environment Minister João Paulo Cabo Bianco said that the figure is the lowest ever recorded for the month of May and that Brazil is on track to reach its lowest annual levels once the data is consolidated next semester. He said that the month typically sets higher deforestation because it marks the start of Amazon's dry season. On June 2, the Trump administration proposed 25% tariffs on imports from Brazil, saying the country's 10th biggest economy engages in trade practices that are unreasonable and that burden or restrict U.S. commerce. War in Ukraine has gone on longer than World War II. Trench warfare, war of drones rule the front. The war in Ukraine has often been compared to World War I for its brutal infantry assaults and heavy casualties. Yet the idea that it could be by any measure surpass a conflict so long and bloody that French soldiers hoped it would be the last of the last once seemed unthinkable. That is just what happened on Thursday. The war in Ukraine, which reached 1,569 days, or more than 4 years and 3 months, now has outlasted World War I. When President Vladimir Putin of Russia sent his troops into Ukraine in February of 2022, he believed the country would fall within days. After Ukraine pushed the Russians back and the conflict settled into a war of attrition, even many of those fighting could not imagine it would last this long. But the war has raged on, and with the peace talks stalled, it shows no sign of ending soon. Polls suggest that about half of the Ukrainians believe it will not end before next year, which would push it closer to another threshold, the duration of World War II, which lasted 6 years. And there are many Ukrainians who would argue that the current war really began in 2014 when Russian troops seized Crimea. Military analysts also note that both conflicts reshaped the nature of warfare through the introduction of new technologies, planes and tanks a century ago, drones across the air, sea, and land today. In both cases, the advances made war only more brutal for humans. The comparison begins with the opening phase of both wars. In 1914, the Germans launched a rapid offense toward Paris in the hope of seeing a swift victory. Russian forces had the same objective when they raced against Kyiv, Ukraine's capital, in 2022. In both cases, the attackers came close to their target, but they were ultimately driven back. Eventually, both wars settled into mostly static fighting along a large frozen front. When soldiers on the Ukraine battlefield hunkered down in trenches and bunkers in the late 2022. Historians described it as a return to World War I-style trench warfare. That calculus later changed in Ukraine with the introduction of a new class of weapons, drones. Networks of open trenches were rendered unsafe as drones monitored the battlefield around the clock and struck with greater precision than artillery shells. As drones have come to dominate the battlefield, World War I-style opposing trench networks have given way to miles-wide contested combat areas scattered with dugouts. In this kill zone, any movement is targeted quickly by drones. Large-scale troop assaults of the kind seen a century ago have become all but impossible under the constant gaze of drones. Such assaults have been replaced with attacks by just one or two soldiers. Tanks, first introduced in 2016, were still a feared weapon in the first years of the war in Ukraine. They are rarely used now because their size makes them easy for targets for drones, though some tanks have been retrofitted with protective metal cages that turn them into Mad Max-style vehicles. Drone strikes on Russia's oil assets, the backbone of its economy, are designed to curb Moscow's ability to finance its war. Kiev lacks the manpower to replace the offensives of World War II, but it has flooded the battlefield with small attack drones in the hope of inflicting unsustainable losses on the Russian army. This is World War I, but with drones. Women who fled Iran set to be deported to Central Africa by the New York Times. The Trump administration is preparing to deport nearly two dozen people in the Central African Republic on Thursday. The flight, which is also expected to include migrants from Afghanistan and Syria, would mark the first such deportation to the Central African Republic, a deeply impoverished country that has been plagued by conflict. The country is so dangerous that the State Department states on its website, "Do not travel for any reason." The Trump administration is working to find ways to deport people despite these court orders. The government is cutting deals with other countries willing to take them. The existence of a deportation deal with the Central African Republic was earlier reported by Reuters. It has no functioning health care system, and fears of violence are constant despite a tentative peace agreement between armed groups and the state. Trump campaigned on a promise to curtail immigration, and the White House is looking to step up deportations to third world countries as a way to make good on that pledge. The deportation of Iranians would be another example of that policy, extending to groups that had previously been seen as U.S. allies or aligned with its values. The administration had been in talks with the Congo to deport more than 1,000 Afghans who had aided the U.S. war effort in their country, rather than allowing them to immigrate to the U.S. as planned. Negotiations stalled after a wave of public criticism, leaving the administration to seek alternatives. And after that, we will be back after this brief message.
Hi, the Bay State Council of the Blind has available free Braille copies of a new publication from the CDC. It's entitled COVID-19 Vaccination Guidance, and this one-volume publication focuses on information about the vaccines and vaccine safety. To get your free copy, send your name and mailing address to kim.charlson@perkins.org. That's kim.charlson@perkins.org.
And you are listening to Boston Globe Live, a production of Audio Journal. And here is Alita with more news.
Continuing with today's business news, sales tax holiday set for August 8 to 9 weekend by Sam Drysdale, State House News. Savings-minded shoppers plan accordingly. The State House and Senate on Thursday agreed that the weekend of August 8th to 9th will serve as this year's sales tax holiday. Buyers can avoid sales tax on many purchases, although critics say it doesn't generate much new economic activity and merely shifts consumer buying patterns. But during the annual sales tax holiday weekend, the state will suspend collection of 6.25% sales tax on most items that retail for less than $2,500. In other business news, under talking points, tech, Amazon, data centers use 2.5 billion gallons of water. Amazon.com, Inc. said its data centers used 2.5 billion gallons of water worldwide last year, or about 5% of the amount Metro Seattle consumes annually. The world's largest cloud computing company said the disclosure shows that it cools server farms more efficiently than some of its large tech industry peers. Amazon's announcement arrives amid a politically charged debate over how much water and electricity centers use. Some states and cities, including Amazon's home base in Seattle, have considered or implemented moratoriums on construction of new server farms, in part to allow for further study. U.S. jobless aid filings rise, still historically low despite Iran war. U.S. applications for jobless aid rose modestly last week, but remain at historically low levels despite economic headwinds brought on by the war in Iran. The number of Americans filing for unemployment aid for the week ending June 6th rose by 4,000 to 229,000, the Labor Department reported on Thursday. That's the most since early February, before the U.S. and Israel launched attacks on Iran, but still considered a healthy level. Under health care, survey, health insurance costs set to rise in U.S. U.S. companies plan to charge more for employee health plans next year as soaring drug prices drive up insurance costs. Two-thirds of large companies expect to raise monthly premiums for employee health coverage through paycheck deductions in 2027, according to a survey of businesses with at least 500 employees by benefit consultancy Mercer. About half, 48%, of employers say they will make other changes, such as raising deductibles and co-pays, that will increase how much workers pay out-of-pocket care. And in food, inspection fails to explain botulism in baby formula. Federal inspectors found no evidence that By Heart, Inc.'s infant formula production process caused botulism outbreak that sickened dozens of babies, according to a new report that pointed to contaminated ingredients as a more likely culprit. Workforce Pell Grants to provide free education. Opportunities in non-degree jobs. By John Marcus, Washington Post. At a time when polls show two-thirds of Americans think higher education is no longer worth the price, Forsyth Technical Community College has a message for them. College, the school says, could cost you nothing. The planned marketing slogan highlights the new Workforce Pell Grants, the most dramatic expansion of more than 50 years of federal grants for education after high school, and the challenge of getting the word out about it. Few consumers know that hundreds of millions of dollars will be available as soon as this summer for non-degree programs, according to educators, researchers, and policy analysts. Previously limited to students seeking associate or bachelor degrees, Pell Grants will be extended to non-degree job training programs in high-demand fields, including nursing, phlebotomy, childcare, truck driving, welding, car repair, and HVAC. The lack of awareness about the money becoming available has been compounded by the fact that many states, which are responsible for the implementation, aren't ready to implement it. In today's Metro news, Nantucket fisherman reels in releases great white shark, by Hannah Goki, Globe correspondent. A Nantucket fisherman reeled in his first great white shark Sunday with a crowd watching and cheering behind him. A video posted by Elliot Sudol on his Instagram account shows him carefully reeling the shark onto Nobadir Beach before jumping on its back and quickly removing the hook. It probably took 300 yards off my line. 100 yards. It probably took 300 yards of line off my reel. We immediately could tell it was something big, Sudol said Wednesday. Sudol, 37, said as soon as he realized he had caught a great white shark, he knew he had to release it immediately. Great whites are prohibited species in U.S. waters, meaning no intentional targeting is allowed, Sudol said. He said he posted the video to show how to release a nearly 9-foot shark back into the water. Sudol said, he became known as Nantucket's shark wrestler after the Globe published an article about him in 2015. Sudol first gained widespread attention in 2013 after a video of him battling a shark on Nantucket gathered millions of views. From working on a fishing boat in Alaska at 18 to tagging sharks on yachts in the Caribbean, Sudol said he has caught everything cool in North America. Now, decades after fishing in his own backyard pond, Sudol is showing a local teenager the ropes. On Sunday, Stone Florence, 14, helped Sudol reel in the great white. It's so funny. Everyone's been calling him my apprentice, but I just started running a boat for their family here in Nantucket, Sudol said. And he's just a really smart kid, obsessed with fishing, and now he's catching great whites. I was the exact same way, obsessed. While great whites are rarer than other shark species, a sighting in June on Nantucket is a common occurrence, according to John Chisholm, a shark expert at the New England Aquarium. White sharks like to hang out right on the surface zone, so when you go in the water, you need to be aware, Chisholm said. Sharks are not targeting humans, but in the case of white sharks that feed on seals, you know that's a human-sized prey item. Sudo said that he has never been badly injured while dealing with a shark, but has cut up his hands on razor-sharp teeth a few times while pulling out the fishing hook. Catching a white shark is not many people's thing to do. That's man versus nature challenge, catching something on your own, Chisholm said. It's not as easy as people might think. Quincy to celebrate 75th Flag Day Parade by Chloe Pisani, Globe correspondent. Quincy. Quincy will celebrate Flag Day Saturday with its 75th annual parade, the longest running in the country, city officials said. Coinciding with America's 250th anniversary, the parade will honor several Quincy history keepers as grand marshals, officials said in a statement Tuesday. The grand marshals will be members of organizations who preserve and teach the city's history. Representatives from the National Park Service, Quincy Historical Society, Adams Presidential Center, the City of Quincy's Historic District Heritage Department, and the Granite Railway and Quarry Museum will serve as the marshals. In today's weekend news, it's a bitter little world. Noir City Festival returns to Boston by Odie Henderson, Globe staff. Every character in a noir has to face the music. So it's not surprising the theme of this year's edition of Noir City Boston's Face the Music Festival, running from June 12th to 15th at the Brattle, is focusing on the well-known genre film noir. Your resident noirista has some choices for you. Here are some of the ones to look forward to. Black Angel from 1946. Blues in the Night from 1941. Anatomy of a Murder from 1959. All Night Long from 1962. Gilda with Rita Hayworth, Bogey and Bacall into Have and Have Not, 1945, and A Man Called Adam. And that's about it for today.
You've been listening to Boston Globe Live, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Program is funded in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind, the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, and UNIVET.
Audio journalist on Earth. This is Bill Ruggieri. Here can be your latest weather forecast for Friday, June 12, 2026. Here's my latest updated forecast. For today, sunny, hazy, hot, and humid today with scattered afternoon showers and heavy thunderstorms. Some of the thunderstorms may produce strong gusty winds, small hail, and locally heavy downpours. Highs today near 93 degrees. For tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely until midnight, otherwise partly cloudy after midnight. Low around 71 degrees. And the outlook for Saturday is calm for mostly sunny skies with showers and heavy thunderstorms likely in the afternoon. Some of the storms may produce strong gusty winds, small hail, and locally heavy downpours. Highs on Saturday near 88 degrees. Saturday night, mostly clear skies, warm and humid, low around 69 degrees. And the outlook for Sunday is calm for mostly sunny skies, warm and humid, with chances of afternoon thunderstorms on Sunday. Highs Sunday up into the lower 90s. That, folks, is your latest weather forecast for today, Friday, June 12th, 2026. This has been Bill Ruggieri saying have a good and happy day, everybody, and please stay tuned for more programming back at our Patricia Ray, Fletcher Studios, and Worcester, Massachusetts. Take care, have a great Friday and a great weekend, and stay cool, everybody. Bye.
Hello, sports fans. Did you know that Audio Journal has a weekly one-hour program that features news and inspiring stories about disabled and visually impaired folks participating in sports at the local, national, and international level? That's AJ Sports Page. Tune in on Fridays from 5 to 6 p.m. That's AJ Sports Page, airing every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Archived episodes are available on demand on our website, www.audiojournal.org. That's AJ Sports Page, a production of Audio Journal. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Audio Journal is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.